Now, when it comes to showbiz, you don't get anything more exciting, anything more entertaining, anything more, I suppose, pay-per-view-like than RHI. I do say that with my tongue firmly in my cheek, but from time to time, it becomes just slightly more interesting. Now, there's considerable coverage ongoing of RHI at the moment, especially when Arlene Foster is in the chair being grilled. And indeed, she's at loggerheads with the Civil Service Chief, David Stirling, over dramatic claims at the RHI inquiry about the minuting of ministerial meetings. That's one of the lines in the Irish News this morning. I want to speak to John Manley from the paper. John, it is always watched and listened to with more attention whenever Arlene Foster is speaking, or any of the big hitters or big players in this are actually speaking. Is there much coming from it? Do you feel that's unnerving Arlene Foster?
Well, yes, you're right, Frank. And, you know, in terms of, you know, live political events in Northern Ireland, this really is, you know, major box office. But perhaps I should confess that, like many sequels, that the third installment of Arlene Foster's evidence maybe isn't as gripping as the previous installments. That said, there are still revelations. There are still things being said which leave you flabbergasted, basically. And, well, Mrs. Foster, I suppose she's looking comfortable where she is, but every now and then her sentence is tailed off and she looks a little sheepish when she's challenged by the expert panel and the inquiry council.
I suppose she has to be very careful that she's not caught out and made look stupid. It's one thing having your theory on how it all panned out and believing that it's not your fault, but when you're being quizzed by someone as skilled as the chair, you could be made look a bit daft.
Certainly. The questioning is at times, you know, very ponderous, but it's very deliberate. It's setting out the basis of this scheme. And yes, Mrs. Foster has to be very careful. I'm sure she's made, I believe, two written submissions to the inquiry. And she must, you know, it's important that everything she says tallies with what she has said. And very often, you know, the council would go through line by line her written evidence and ask her then to comment and to verify bits of that and give it context.
And how sensitive are the politicians about the note-taking and the freedom of information and the suggestion from David Stirling that this has changed in recent times, the note-taking?
Yes, this, I suppose, is the RHI inquiry sideshow. It's what I think they used to call a bubble in soap opera terms, you know, triggered by last month's claim by David Stirling that the practice of note-taking had lapsed since devolution was restored over a decade ago. Now, the context he'd given to that was that the DUP and Sinn Féin were sensitive to criticism, and therefore they didn't want to say anything at meetings with officials that may later come out under be disclosed under freedom of information legislation. Now, first of all, Andrew Crawford, Mrs. Foster's special advisor, has refuted this. He said he wasn't aware of it, and as far as he was aware, people were taking notes. Mrs. Foster, too, she's described the now, it is an inference. At no point did David Stirling say, you know, I was told never to take notes, but, it, you know, as I say, it's an inference from what he said. But Mrs. Foster has described that as nonsense, and we'd a story in yesterday's Irish News, which subsequent to David Stirling's evidence, Michelle O'Neill, a Sinn Féin deputy leader, had written to Mr. Stirling, and she, you know, had sort of quite an angry letter, which she accused him of saying that he had ignored inconvenient facts and his inference lacked objectivity. Now, there was a reference to this made yesterday by the inquiry chairman and the counsel, David Schofield, that really the public and the media, when looking at these issues, really ought to take the evidence in the round rather than focusing on sensational sound bites and little individual bits of evidence. But we are the media, Frank, sometimes. You know, I'm not saying we sensationalise things, but we focus in on the juicy bits.
Absolutely, and you pressy it. You know, you're not going to pressy it into the really boring lines. You're going to condense it to what is of interest, what people are talking about, what people on the bus are having a yarn about. And if you can use a term like blank check and it being signed or not being signed, you will make a reference to it. And will Arlene Foster be able to shake off the sort of the image that there was a blank check going around here?
No, I don't think so. I think that there would need to be some major bit of redeeming evidence. You know, when she said once upon a time she wasn't across every jot and tittle of her department, and that is becoming increasingly evident as time goes on, and in the evidence she's giving. You know, and she did effectively give a blank check. She'd write a blank check. You know, she did not have... She claimed she didn't have the correct information. Then, well, she should have sought out the correct information, or at least questioned what she was being given. And she, you know, she concedes that she wrote, signed off the budget for this scheme, which was effectively, she said she just thought it would cost $25 million, but that was for only 3 years of the scheme, which was going to run for another 22 years.
Just one final question on it, John, because we also talk to Sam occasionally about it from the newsletter, and we speak to other writers on it as well here on the programme. Are we getting a sense that, yes, the facts will be reported accurately by both papers, but there's a slant from the Irish News that will be making Arlene seem as uncomfortable as possible, whereas in the unionist community, they will make Arlene feel a little more comfortable?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I think that that's perhaps unfair on Sam's coverage, which I believe has been impartial. And, you know, there's no escaping it. The focus is on Arlene Foster and on the DUP, certainly at the minute, on her role in the scheme. So I think, and I think, if I recall from the time, Frank, when this all really exploded, I took calls from many unionists who were equally outraged as any nationalist. So that's not to say that nationalists will make political capital from it, but I also think Arlene Foster's unionist opponents will also make political capital for it.
Yeah, I should emphasise, I wasn't criticising Sam, I was sort of asking you, are you making it a little more uncomfortable for Arlene than you need to?
Oh, well, as I, there has to be said, there's a degree of schadenfreude, but I hope that's maybe just reading between the lines, and it wouldn't be that obvious.
Yeah, it's a great skill for a journalist to have, John. It's always a pleasure having you on, but thank you.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you. John Manley, the political correspondent at the Irish News. You can read his detailed article if you pick up the paper. Good morning to you. It's coming up on 20 past nine. This is the Frank Mitchell phone-in. By the way, I should emphasise, we're blessed with the skills of political correspondents here in Northern Ireland, whether in the newsletter, the Belfast Telegraph, the Irish News, UTV, BBC, or wherever. We're spoilt for choice. Right, good morning to you. 90 333 105 077 66 105 105.